Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Natasha Crane podcast. Today, I am thrilled to have Greg Kokel on the show. He is one of the wisest people I have ever had the pleasure of personally knowing. I think of him like a wise owl. Not a wise old owl, just a wise owl. Greg is the founder and president of Stand to Reason, an organization which actually just celebrated its 30th anniversary this year. He's written 7 books, including The Story of Reality and Tactics, which are 2 books that I recommend all the time. I'm sure you've heard me recommend them on this podcast. Greg has also just released a new outstanding book, which everyone listening needs to get, called Street Smarts, Using Questions to Answer Christianity's Toughest Challenges. And it's that book that is going to frame the theme for our conversation today. On the personal side, Greg has been a wonderful mentor to me over the last several years, and he has supported my writing and speaking in all kinds of ways, which I am so grateful for. And I can pretty uniquely say that I have been on a boat on the Sea of Galilee with Greg and his wife, which sounds really random, but we were all part of a trip to Israel for apologists back in 2019. It was actually 4 years ago this month. It was October. Wow. And we got to share some really memorable times. So, Greg, it's wonderful to have you on the show today. Welcome.
Well, thank you. It was fun to be on the boat with you, too. And as for the owl reference, I am the old one. I'll take that. I'm not sure about the wise owl part, but I it's very kind of you to say that. Thanks, Natasha. And sweet to talk with you again.
We're just going with the wise owl part for today. Okay. Do you remember that day on the Sea of Galilee, how windy it was? Yeah. I was thinking about that. I was actually looking back through pictures when I was preparing for this and thinking about that day. And I was looking at that. In every picture, we have the wind blowing all over us.
It was quite
an adventure.
David Wood was hanging over the bow and screaming at the lake, taking a picture of it. Hey, you, Jesus stomped all over you. You know, so it was really amazing. It was great to be there with you and so many others.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a very memorable trip. Well, let's dive into talking about the new book. It's fabulous, like I said, and it's so practical, which is something that I really, really appreciate about it. I mean, everything that you do is practical, but this book especially just dives into giving people scripts to work with. I mean, it's that detailed that you show for all these different topics. Here's how a dialogue could go and gives people a lot of examples. So, I'm the admin on a few different Facebook groups for the kinds of Christians who are engaging pretty regularly with people online or in person on questions of faith. And oftentimes what that means is that people will post screenshots in those groups of what non-believers have said, and then they'll ask, hey, how should I respond to this, or how do I convince this person of fill in the blank? And I think there's often this sense that there's a lot of pressure to get it right. And I appreciate that, because we don't want to give bad answers. But I think the heart of your book is to take some of that pressure off Christians, as you show that asking good questions can be even more effective sometimes than giving even the most polished answer. So can you start by explaining why that's the case? Why is asking questions even better sometimes than giving answers?
Yeah, well, I have a chapter in the new book, Street Smarts, and of course, this concept of asking questions goes back to the Tactics book, of which Street Smarts is kind of a sequel. So those who have read the Tactics book, they'll understand where I'm going with Street Smarts, but you don't need to have read that, because Street Smarts is a standalone book. But the chapter in Street Smarts is, I think, titled Questions Keep You Safe. And we are in a tough situation here in our culture now, and it's getting harder. The title Street Smarts is specifically meant to capture this notion of the discomfort and exposure and vulnerability that Christians feel in the marketplace of ideas right now. And the marketplace of ideas doesn't have to necessarily mean when you're on TV or talking and being interviewed in some fancy smanchy situation, but rather just everybody that you know. It could be college students, it could be professors, it could be your friends, people you work with, it could be your own family members. And everything goes fine until you touch on certain topics, which turn out to be the most important issues that we can talk about, okay? And then since Christians are personas non grata largely in our culture now with their ideas, then them's fighting words kind of thing, and Christians just back off, all right? Partly because they don't know how to handle themselves. They're not street smart, okay? And partly because they have a mistaken understanding about how evangelism works, biblically speaking. Okay, maybe we'll get to that in a bit. But for whatever reason, they are backing off. And you ask a question here about asking questions. And it's actually, our dialogue is a good example. You ask the question, I respond, okay, you're sitting there relaxed, calm, no pressure on you. But I'm the one who's doing the talking because I'm the one who has asked the question, even though you're the one who's directing the conversation. And this is a big advantage of asking questions. You're in the driver's seat of the conversation. You're not falling backwards on the defensive, whatever. If you initiate an interaction with someone by asking questions pertaining to their issues or their questions or their challenges to Christianity, it immediately tosses the ball into the other person's court. It buys you some time. Okay, it allows you to get valuable information from them about their view. Because, Natasha, there is hardly a time when I engage anybody in a Q&A after an event. I spoke at three universities last week. And afterwards, we always have Q&A, and there's hardly ever a challenge or a question that comes up that is not loaded with ambiguities that need clarification. And sometimes the confusion or the heart of the challenge on the Christian, it hinges on an ambiguity, okay? And so when I ask questions to clarify the ambiguity, that's the very first step of the game plan. I ask them what they mean by that. Well, now they have to think more about it. So what the questions help do is, first of all, they throw the ball in the other person's court, give you some breathing room. They give you a tremendous amount of safety because when you're asking a question, you're not making a statement. When you're making a statement, you have to answer for it, right? Somebody can challenge it. But if you're asking a question, there's no pressure on you. You're in the shallow end of the pool. You're also getting information that's valuable about moving forward if you're able to. And sometimes we don't move forward. And, you know, sometimes I don't move forward, you know. We all have limitations not only on our knowledge but on the circumstances. Maybe these things are just going to die a natural death with the person we're talking to, and that's okay too. But you want questions to keep you in the driver's seat, and these are all valuable things, and they get you valuable information. One other thing about questions, when you ask people questions about their view, about their challenge, for example, or about their worldview, not only do you want to understand it more clearly, you want them to understand it more clearly. And this is a huge deal. Because people of all sorts, there's both sides of the aisle, Christians, non-Christians, they repeat what they've heard. They're socialized to say certain things. And so there's lots of socialized challenges to Christianity that we have in the culture right now, and people are firing these things out. That doesn't mean they've thought about it. And so a big part of my asking a question about what they mean by a certain point, and we'll probably, as we talk, we'll have some more examples of that, is not only for so I understand them clearly, so I don't get them wrong, I don't misrepresent them, a straw man kind of thing, and that's polite to try to understand another person, but it's also because I want them to understand themselves. I want them to get a clearer picture on what they're actually claiming. And sometimes that's a showstopper. I have examples in the book where this has happened. Just one question, a simple question. What do you mean by that? Clarification questions out of the gate. And that's enough to get the person thinking about their own view and wondering. And of course, this is my goal, ultimately, is not to close the deal. I'm not looking to pray to receive Christ with that person. I'm looking to get them thinking. Because I know that any person's journey towards Christ takes time. And it means changing all kinds of ideas they have about the nature of reality. And it's not going to happen overnight. So I'm not looking to do the harvest. I'm looking to do the gardening, basically. So anyway, those are the strengths of questions. It's to keep the Christian safe and give them good information in the context of a friendly dialogue all at the same time.
That's great. You just hit on a whole lot of things that I want to unpack. But let's start with one of the points that you made there I just love so much, where you're talking about you want to help people understand what they believe, which might sound counterintuitive to some people, but mm-hmm. I think that overwhelmingly that is what we see in culture mm-hmm. today, that people don't know what they believe and mm-hmm. why. And it reminds me of a statistic that I share quite a bit in my speaking and in my writing, because I think it's so relevant to what you're talking about here. Mm-hmm. According to Arizona Christian University's Cultural Cultural Research Center, 88% of Americans embrace an impure, unrecognizable worldview that blends ideas from multiple perspectives.
Right.
And when you were talking, it was just making me think about that, because it strikes me that that's part of the reason why asking good questions is so effective. People truly aren't thinking about what they believe and why. The research bears this out. 88% of people are just cobbling stuff together. They end up holding these beliefs that are not even logically coherent.
Now, Christians do that all the time, too.
Absolutely.
I talk to some Christians who say, I'm a Christian, and I believe in reincarnation.
Right.
And my question is, like, I'm thinking inside, huh? You know, how does that work? Because Christianity doesn't, I should say reincarnation does no work in Christianity. It's like trying to put a carburetor on a computer. So that's why I'm going to say, how does that work, reincarnation and Christianity? Explain to me how those fit together. And they're not going to be able to do it because they're not trying to think coherently about their worldview. This is the point you're making here. They are just picking and choosing what they like. It sounds good to them. And so, therefore, this radical incoherence of all these, this hodgepodge of beliefs that ultimately make no sense.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. But people aren't realizing that they don't make sense because they just don't stop to think about it. Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right. When we say that 88% of Americans are embracing this unrecognizable worldview, that includes a whole lot of people who identify as Christians.
Right.
Because we know from other research that 65% of Americans identify as Christians, mm-hmm. and fewer than 5% have a biblical worldview. So that 88% is a hodgepodge of people who identify as all kinds of things. So people who identify as Christians definitely are not off the hook in that. We're seeing a lot of problems with that in the church. Yeah.
By the way, that's where the question, some form of the question, when you say you're, what do you mean by that, comes in. When you say you're a Christian, this, lots of people have different senses of what that means. And I'm curious, when you say it, what does that mean to you? What is a Christian from your perspective? It's a totally fair question because I'm confused and I'm not trying to put them down. I'm just trying to get clarity on it.
Right.
And that's what you have 65%. That self-identify as Christian, but obviously that's not – it's not the case that these are disciplined followers of Christ, disciples of Jesus, right?
So when you do start asking those questions, when people say that they identify as a Christian or anything else, and you start asking them about their beliefs and you start to raise some of these logical issues to the surface by their own answers – that it comes to light really quickly, right? Mm-hmm. That these things don't make sense together.
Right.
But that also can have the potential to embarrass people a little bit, I think. It's kind of like you caught them. And mm-hmm. I've seen that happen even in some of the engagements that I've had with people where they get to a point where it's a little bit defensive because they mm-hmm. realize that what they're saying doesn't necessarily function together. So
right.
I'm just curious, do you have any advice on that in terms of how Christians can make sure that when they are asking questions that bring to light some of these inconsistencies, mm-hmm. how can we do that in a way that avoids making people feel stupid or defensive?
Right. And I can't guarantee that won't happen, but I do have some thoughts on that. And one of them, the point is, and I call this question-asking maneuver tactic, the Columbo tactic. And some of your listeners might know who he is. Most won't. Columbo is the TV detective who comes in under the radar. He looks like he's innocuous, he's harmless at the crime scene, and then he begins scratching his head and muttering to himself, and I don't know, there's something about this thing that bothers me, you know. And then he asks the question. So he's gathering this information. Well, there's a style there of appearing to be harmless, okay? And I actually think this helps. If you act like you're looking for blood with your questions, and unfortunately, this is the way a lot of these conversations go nowadays. These are not gladiator events. That's what we are involved with, although most of the conversations in public about controversial issues turn out to be that. Who can draw first blood? So we're not posturing that way, and we are demonstrating a genuine interest in the other person's view. Now, the reason we are genuinely interested in their view is because we think their view is false, and being false, it matters, and we're trying to help them understand what the truth is so that it's better for them. Okay, so we have their best interests in mind, even though, yes, it is the case that we're trying to question the legitimacy of their view. We think they're wrong. Now, we want to be careful how we do that, but sometimes there's no other way to get around it. When a doctor looks at your medical condition and says, you're sick, and the things that you're doing are killing you, and you've got to stop doing this, this, and this, or you're going to die. Okay. Well, you know, the key there is he's looking at, after the well-being of the person. Now, if they have a nice bedside manner, okay, that's better. But even if they don't, the key is the truth. Now, what we're trying to do is have a really good bedside manner, so to speak, and tell the truth. And now we're, the bedside manner is informed by the way we maneuver with these kinds of questions. And the questions, generally speaking, are questions that are going to, as this is the street smarts approach. Once we've laid a foundation, and now we're trying to deal with an issue, okay? And I deal in the book with, I mean, all kinds, atheism, two chapters, problem of evil, chapter, can we be good without God, chapter, two chapters on abortion, two chapters on the Bible, one on Bible and science and the other one on biblical problems like slavery and alleged genocide, sex, gender, marriage, Jesus, is he the only way? Is he really God or the Son of God? So we just cover the spectrum of the kinds of things that people are facing, okay? So I'm giving them help to see what's wrong with those challenges. But now what we want to do is, a lot of books do that. What this book will do is they, okay, now here are the questions that you can use to enter into a dialogue that's friendly, that does, you do want to turn a corner with them. And so there's, a, in a certain sense, in kind of the common vernacular now, there's a mic drop moment, all right, where, okay, the final question, bang, this. Okay, that's the one that counts. That's the one that's meant to get them thinking. And to put a stone in their shoe. Now, if we're gracious and we're being friendly in the process, and we're coming across like we care about the person. Okay, it is unlikely that people are going to get mad or have their feelings hurt, but it is going to happen. Sometimes, like you just mentioned. It hasn't happened that much with me, but some people have mentioned this. So now I ask the question: What's the alternative? Okay, if we're so concerned that we don't want to make them feel bad, there's no other technique that's as gentle as this approach. The alternative is that we do nothing. We never say anything that might possibly offend anybody. Okay, and so let's look at the ministry of Jesus. Jesus, you know, he was pretty aggressive in many cases. Sometimes he was coy. Woman at the well, John 4. John 3? Pretty aggressive with Nicodemus, the religious leader, okay? Different styles, a different stroke for different folks, we used to say back in the 60s. And that applies here in terms of being careful to how does Paul put it in Colossians 4? Make the most of every opportunity, let your speech be with grace, so you know how to respond to each person. That's what he says. We want to be sensitive to each person. But I can't guarantee that somebody's not going to be bugged. But keep in mind, sometimes people are bugged for the right reason. Right. They get mad and they pound off somewhere else. And I imagine that there are times that any of your listeners and viewers can say, I remember when somebody told me the truth and it made me really bugged and I got really mad, but it still stuck with me and it made a difference. And this is what we're trying to do. Communicate the truth as graciously, as accurately, as persuasively as possible. And then let God take care of the rest. We can't promise that we're not going to hurt somebody's feelings. People are very, very sensitive. Hurting feelings means you disagree with me and you should be quiet because I don't like what you said. That's what hurt my feelings or I'm offended amounts to today. So I can't guarantee that. But I can't think of any other way that more ironically, graciously, amicably engages people about the truth than the tactical game plan.
I think that's such a good thing for people to hear, that you can do things in a gentle way and still people are not going to like you sometimes. But right. That doesn't get you off the hook from needing to do it in the first place and to share truth with people. Exactly. I wrote an article a couple of years ago. I can't remember the title of it right now, but it was something about how Christians need to care less about our reputation in the culture, because there are a lot of people who are very concerned with how the secular culture perceives us. And so we just need to keep changing until they like us. It reminds me kind of the He Gets Us campaign, that kind of thing, rescuing Jesus's reputation from, you know, his followers to some degree. I mean, yes, we have to do everything with gentleness and respect, but to some degree, people are going to be offended by the message. They're not going to like it. That doesn't mean that we should gauge how well we've shared truth by whether or not people are offended. Yeah. So I think that's a really important thing for
people
to hear.
By the way, more in this culture than ever before, because people are taught implicitly in our culture, they're socialized, that saying I'm offended or that hurts my feelings is a legitimate way to parry any alternate view. I mean, this is where this whole concept of snowflakes comes from. So I've never seen this before. I mean, it's just been the last 10 or 15 years that this has come front and center as a way of responding. And then it's our job never to hurt anybody's feelings. If they don't like what we have to say, we have to be silent. Of course, that's not an option for disciples of Jesus of Nazareth.
That's right. So I want to come back to the Columbo tactics that you mentioned. And just for people who aren't familiar with that, I just wanted you to quickly outline, like, what are those questions that you're referring to? You kind of mentioned one as we've gone along here, but there are three questions, basically, that you outline as your Columbo tactics that can be applied. It's a framework to use in any kind of conversation to bring out this information from people and to understand better what they're saying. And like you said, to help them understand their own worldview better. So what are those three questions? And then we'll get into applying those a little bit.
I recap in Street Smarts, I recap in summary form in one chapter the game plan that I spend a lot of time talking about in the book Tactics. And there are three steps to the game plan. And so what I tell people first is that the very first thing you want to do before you think about anything down the line, don't even worry about what comes next. First, I just want you to gather information. Excuse me. That's the first step. Gather information. All right. And there's a model question. And the question is, what do you mean by that? So if a person says, well, I'm an atheist, well, don't think about all the arguments against atheism that you have to come up with if you can remember them. Just ask a question. Really, what kind of atheist are you? Okay. There are different kinds of atheists. All right. You just draw them out. Okay. You want to get some more information. Or they say, well, the Bible's been changed, passage down through time. Really? How does that work? Tell me more about that. Okay, you want them to flesh out the challenge or the issue. Sometimes a person might say, what about the problem of evil? And I'll say, what about it? And they say, well, it's a problem for you, isn't it? What exactly is the problem? Now, I know what they're getting at, but I just keep throwing the ball back in their court because I want them to flesh these things out in more clear fashion. And that's why some form of the question, what do you mean by that? And there are a lot of ways to vary it, but some form of that question is your question here. What we're doing is we're getting intel. That's all we're doing. And sometimes the intel may be about their view that's counter to ours, and it might be about a challenge that they're offering us. And do you take the Bible literally? Now, I trick audiences all the time when I'm talking about this and I'm telling them about the importance of this question. And then I ask them, and this is Christian audiences, I say, oh, by the way, in your church here, do you take the Bible literally? Everybody goes, yes. And I said, so you think Jesus is a stick? Huh? Yeah, I'm the vine. You are the branch as well, sticks. Are we just a big bush? Oh, what was the problem there? You forgot to ask the question, what do you mean by that? And I deal with the literal issue in the book when we talk about the Bible because this is confusing, all right? We want to be clear what exactly they mean. Generally, when people say, do you take the Bible literally, they mean, do you believe the unbelievable things? That's what they mean. But you want to get down to that, okay, and then draw them out. So, or do you believe in evolution? Well, what do you mean by that? Depends what kind of evolution you have in mind. So these are just quick examples of how, and in the dialogues, where I'm actually moving into the subsequent steps of the game plan, I'm still using this first question to clarify issues, to get clear on what they mean, okay? And so that's the first step. What do you mean by that? Gathering information. Now, the second step, you're going to gather a different kind of information. The first, you're finding out what they believe. The second step, you want to know why they believe it. So if a person says, well, the Bible's been changed. Okay, help me understand what you think took place. Blah, 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 if they know. Okay, now, why do you think that's actually what happened? Why do you think that's actually what happened? I mean, a lot of people will say, I saw a TikTok on this. Well, the Bible was compiled at the Council of Nicaea. All right. Well, this is absolute, utter nonsense. We know what happened at the Council of Nicaea. We have the notes and everything. It's in Schaff's Creeds of Christendom, all the details and everything. And it wasn't about the canon. In any event, though, they say this. So I said, okay, that's what, okay, I clear. Well, how do you know that happened that way? I read it on the internet. Well, wait a minute. You know, what historical sources actually identify that as? So now we know two things. We've asked them one question, clarification question about their view. Now we want to know why they hold the view they hold. So the justification, how did you come to that conclusion, might be the question. Or what are your reasons for thinking that? So now notice that the Christian is still in information gathering mode. There's nothing on me right now. I don't have anything to answer for. I'm still asking generous questions, basic questions to get clarification on that. Okay, now this brings me to the third step. Now, the third step is more difficult because the first two steps, any of your listeners, viewers, can go out right after this show and start using them with no risk to them at all. They are students of other people's view. And if you want to just do that for a few months, that's great. That's really great. Just be a student of other people's views. When you ask these questions, you are forcing them to think more carefully about what they actually believe. The third step, though, is you're using questions to make a point. All right? So you have a target in mind. In order to use the third step, you got to know what the target is. And that's what Street Smarts is all about. For those who have read Tactics, Street Smarts is the third step on steroids, all right? Because now we're dealing with all these different challenges in all these different areas and equipping you with the peculiar, specific questions that can be used with regards to the issue in question. Okay. And, but of course, you have to know if you're going to use your questions to either parry a challenge or to expose a flaw in the other's view, you have to know what's wrong with the challenge or how to expose the flaw. You want to know what the flaw is. And that's what the substance of each chapter is about, to help you see the flaw. And then we go in towards the end of each chapter on each of these topics, as we go into these dialogues, where here is a question that you would use to initiate this kind of cascading conversation with small questions to gather little pieces of information where you're going to that moment where you're asking a question that now properly challenges their view. All with questions. All with questions. We're going to try not to preach, which is hard for some people, including me. All right? The problem with teachers, public speakers, they want to tell everybody everything they know, So that's a liability that you and I share. And you do it so well. We have to curb the impulse to give the right answer by framing the answer in the form of a question so it has more impact. Now, we can just say the answers to these things, and that's going to have an impact. God will use it. But I'm telling you, there's nothing like using questions to do this that it really makes a powerful influence. Can I give you one example just so people can see this in play?
Sure.
Okay, so an atheist says there's no evidence for God or something like that. So, and by the way, I've had this conversation with atheists. I'm thinking of the University of Toronto in particular, but I've had it a number of times with audiences. And now I know, here's the backstory. I know that the fact that the universe came into existence at some point in the past, doesn't matter how long ago it was, Christians, don't worry about that right now. This is believed by everybody. Christians believe it. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Non-Christians believe it. In the beginning, bang, the big bang. Okay, don't worry about the terminology. They agree with us on this point. Okay, great. So we can leverage that as making a point as evidence for God. Okay, so here's how I'm going to do this. I asked the person, do you mind if I ask you some questions? No, that's all right. Well, a couple of questions here are very simple. We'll just play along with me. Okay, sure. First question, do you think that things exist? Yeah. Actually, the guy at University of Toronto said he was uncomfortable even admitting anything, agreeing with me on anything,
He's waiting and for so the
I
trap.
Said, yeah, he says, this microphone exists, is what he said. I said, okay, I can deal with that. Okay, I agree with you. The microphone exists. Now, the things that exist, whatever they are, here's the second question. Have they always existed? He said, no. So they came into existence at some point in the past. Yeah, the Big Bang. So there was when there was nothing, and then there was something. Yes. Okay. Third question. This is the one that matters. What caused everything to come into existence? Now, I tell them, I'll make it easy for you. There's only two options, either something or nothing, or no thing. sometimes I say no thing because people treat nothing like it's something, you know. So right. No thing. Now what's he going to do? He's only got two options. There's no other options than that. He doesn't want to say something. He's an atheist, right? So, if it's something, it's going to have to be outside of the material universe. Therefore, materialism is dead in the water, if that's the case. It would have to be something intelligent and powerful and smart. That means it'd have to be an agent to start this chain of events, the beginning of the universe. Well, he doesn't want to go there, obviously. But what's the only other option? I'm just waiting. So the only other option is that nothing caused the universe with no reason, for no purpose. It just poofed into existence. Now, let me just make an observation. That's worse than magic. Bare minimum, it's a miracle. So in other words, a miracle happened, right? In magic, you've got a magician pulling a rabbit out of a hat, right? But you got no magician here, and you got no hat. You just got the rabbit, the universe. Now, that's it. I'm done. All I'm trying to do is get that person thinking about the implications of his view versus mine. And my point is not to prove the existence of God. My point is to show that the smart money is on God. Because if you want to believe that the universe just came into existence out of nothing for no purpose, no reason, well, that means all of us are here for no purpose, no reason. That's an implication of that worldview. Also, why don't we see things like that happening around us all the time if things could just pop into existence out of nothing? And we don't see that. Our uniform experiences that effects have causes that are adequate to the effect. Okay? So my answer makes sense of what we know. His answer does not. If he wants that one, he's welcome to it. What's interesting about the atheist at the University of Toronto, he said, well, I'm going to go with a scientific answer. And as he's walking away from the microphone, okay, he's dismissing me and my point. I'm going to go with a scientific answer. And I said to him, but you haven't given a scientific answer. There is no scientific answer. If the universe came into existence with no cause, that's not science. Science follows that. Science is going to tell you how that happens. Okay, so science got to work with something. The whole question is, where does something come from? Now, so there's an example. Very simple. That's in the book, all right? But I want you to see something else that's really important, and this is one of the powerful elements of Street Smarts, is that because I wasn't just preaching at him, I could have said, for example, well, the universe exists, things exist, and things haven't always existed. The universe is finite. It came into existence at a point in time, and that was the Big Bang. And so the only explanation that's adequate for the Big Bang is someone or some powerful personal agent caused the Big Bang. Now, what am I doing? I'm preaching. I'm giving the answer. By the way, that's my argument. That's a good answer. But notice that when I put these pieces in place, everything that I say, since he's an objector already, he's a skeptic, that's a prompt for him to take exception with my point. Oh, no, maybe we're butterflies dreaming. Okay, well, then at least you have butterflies dreaming, but nevertheless, that's a pushback. Oh, well, maybe the universe is eternal. Some people think it is eternal. Maybe it's gone on and on. Now you got another pushback. Okay, and so it's very hard to move forward if you are putting the pieces on the table, making assertions, even if they're good. People are going to find something wrong with it. So instead of doing this, I'm asking a straightforward common sense question to which he gives the answer so that he puts the piece on the table, not me. And that's throughout all of this all of our conversations are like this. Then he's putting all those pieces on the table. He's not going to take them off the table. He's not going to take exception with them if he put them there. But he put them there in response to my question. Okay? And then when you get to the, like, mic drop moment, okay, what caused? Now he's got to deal with that issue because that's the important issue. Something or nothing. And what he's going to have to do is either affirm that something like God is the most reasonable option, or he's just going to have to say something kind of ridiculous. No, the universe popped into existence for no reason. All right, if you're satisfied with that, I don't have anything else to say to you. But if you think that's the odds-on favorite, you're fooling yourself.
That's a great example. And if anyone's listening and they're thinking, well, I still wouldn't know how to exactly, you know, get to those questions, that's why the book Street Smarts exists, because Greg's just giving an example, and he has all kinds of chapters with specific topics like that, the ones that he listed off earlier, so that you can see these sample dialogues and start to get a feel for these questions. It is a skill still to be able to ask questions, to be able to get the information like you're talking about. It's something that you have to kind of learn how to do, but exactly. It's a lot easier than knowing every answer, like mm-hmm. we've been talking about. It's not that you don't need to know answers. You eventually want to get to that point. Of course, you want to have content knowledge, right. But learning how to ask these questions, that's exactly what the book is going to help you do.
Yeah, so incidentally, let me jump in just for a quick minute, Natasha. The first two questions, what do you mean by that? How'd you come to that conclusion? Are accessible to any Christian, no right. matter how little you know, or how knowledgeable or aggressive or even obnoxious the other person happens to be. So anybody can enter the game and make a difference, all right? The third step, the street smart step, does require the knowledge that you just mentioned, but that's what I provide in the book and the questions that go with it.
Yeah, and it's very helpful and accessible. And like you said, those first two questions, you could finish listening to this interview and start using those two questions. Mm-hmm. So anyone can take that away, and then the book will help you to go a little bit further, or a lot further actually than that. Let's take another topic from the book, one that I'm passionate about. Your chapter 15 is called Abortion, Only One Question. Right. And I really appreciate that in that chapter, you're not afraid to say the following, quote, "No moral issue, no political issue, no human rights issue has greater significance in the 21st century than abortion," end quote. Mm. Before we talk about how to engage well on this subject, I'd just love for you to explain why that's the case, why you say it's the most significant issue. And if you could, especially frame your answer for Christians who may even broadly say that they are pro-life, but maybe don't see abortion as something that Christians should be so focused on. I encounter this quite a bit, actually. And yeah, so I'd love to hear you address that before we even talk sure. about the questions.
I'm rubbing my head because of frustration when people say, well, I'm a Christian, I'm pro-life, but it's not that big of an issue. Well, what about slavery? I might ask him, if any human being was being enslaved, by the way, and many are, we have more slavery now in the world than we've ever had. And and a lot of it's sexual slavery. Okay. Well, I mean, people get all fired up about that, and they ought to. But these people aren't being murdered to a person. But that's exactly what's happening in abortion. Now, it happens under the cover of the womb, and there's all kinds of euphemisms that we use. We don't – sexual slavery, I mean, that's pretty stark, okay? Abortion, pro-choice, you know, a woman's right. There are all these ways that we euphemize things like they euphemized the Final Solution, right, in Germany, the Third Reich, which resulted in the death of 6 million Jews. And to that point, by the way, from 1973, when Roe versus Wade was first passed, to 2019, we have stats on the abortions, okay, 63 million,
yeah,
459,781 human lives were taken in this country alone. Okay, now we think of 9/11. We just had the 21st memorial of that, and 2,977 people died on American soil that day, that terrible day. 2,977. When you think of how many kids were, more than that, are aborted every day, over 3,000. And if you look at those numbers compared to what, you know, 9/11, that's 21,316 days of death back to back. One was enough to just shake us to our core. But that's what we're facing with abortion. I mentioned the Third Reich. It took Hitler 12 years to vaporize 6 million Jews. We did it in 6 after Roe v. Wade. 6 million defenseless human beings. That's 10 Holocausts back to back. So those statistics ought to hopefully put this in perspective for people.
Yeah.
And this is meant to verify the point that you read from the chapter, that there's no other human rights issue that is more pressing than this one.
it seems like the secular media has been successful not just in convincing secularists that abortion isn't this big of a deal, but also a lot of Christians, because all that language that you mentioned, healthcare, right, or mm-hmm. having abortion access, as if yeah. you have to have access to be able to kill a person.
Right,
I mean, that
right.
language, I think, dumbs it down. It trivializes it. And so even in the minds of Christians, it just becomes another issue rather than mm-hmm. Christians being able to recognize this for the absolute mm-hmm. atrocity that it is. So I really appreciate that you acknowledge that in the book. Mm-hmm. Coming back to the chapter title, Abortion, Only One Question. Tell mm-hmm. us what that one question is and why everything does indeed come back to that one question.
Well, we've been referring to abortion and the consequences of abortion here and using different words like innocent human being and human person, or there are different ways that pro-lifers will refer to this. And of course, that is the issue. The simple question that is the only question that needs to be answered to resolve the moral question of abortion is this one. What is the unborn? What is it? Okay, abortion kills something that's alive. All right. Whether it's right or wrong to take the life of any human being, or I'm sorry, any living thing, I got ahead of myself, any living thing depends on what that is. If the unborn is not a valuable human being, then no justification for abortion is even necessary. You don't have to talk about choice and privacy and my rights and my economics and all that other stuff. Just do it. Yeah. Nobody asks you about those things, and you don't make the case regarding those things if you're having a tooth pulled. Right? Or an appendix removed or something, and just a piece of tissue, your nails clipped, for goodness sake. Just do it. But if the unborn is a valuable human being, then no justification for abortion is adequate, because we do not take the lives of innocent human beings for the reasons people get abortions. And that's the core of it right there. And I have a little illustration I used in a series of questions when I'm in a conversation with someone. This will be very helpful, easy to remember. If I ask the person who is in favor of abortion, at some stage or whatever, in some measure, or maybe fully pro-choice, if your child came up behind you and said to you, Mommy, when you're not looking at them, you're occupied with something else, and to say, Mommy, can I kill this? What is the first question you have to have answered before you can answer that question?
What is it?
What is it? Of course. And they're going to respond that way. What is it? It's an obvious thing. Now, if it's a spider or a cockroach, smash it. You know, if it's your little brother, wait a minute. We have to have a talk. Now, this question is just meant to underscore the point I made a few moments ago. Whether it's right or wrong to take the life of any living things depends on what that thing is, okay? And so now we've narrowed it down to the question, what is it? And this is what we need to pursue. Now, there is no question about what it is. There's no question in anybody's mind. There's never been any question in anybody's mind unless they don't want it. And then there are all kinds of maneuvers to try to get out from behind the reality. When a woman is pregnant, nobody asks her how her piece of tissue is doing. That's how's your baby doing? Okay. What level of development is your baby at? Are you third month, fourth month? Is he kicking yet, or is she kicking yet? He or she? They might say, is it kicking yet? But they understand. I don't like that terminology, but nevertheless, they're talking about a human being. All right. And what's interesting, and I'm just going to put a little side note on this. For Christians who are wondering about this issue biblically, some have gone back to Psalms or whatever to make their point about pro-life view, and I think that's a mistake because Psalms are poetry, and so it's equivocal kind of in its statements. Go to Luke chapter 1, and there's John the Baptist in the second trimester being filled with the Holy Spirit, jumping for joy in his mother's womb because he's in the presence of Jesus, the Son of God, who is a zygote. Okay, there it is. Very straightforward, okay? So the scripture is not unclear on the nature of unborn children, all right? And it's very clear in that passage. So everybody knows. It's just the verbiage when people don't want the pregnancy that then captures people. And I did talk a bit about the problem with language and the way language is used to make killing innocent human beings sound legitimate. And the Nazis were masters at this. And I indicate examples of that in that chapter.
And you give a lot of great examples, and I love that illustration that you mentioned. I was going to ask you to talk about that anyway, about the little girl or little boy asking, hey, mommy, can I kill this? I love that. That's very memorable, easy for people to understand. I want to leave some time for listener questions, but I want to throw just a couple of quotes at you to show how you can use this whole strategy of bringing it back to the one question with people. So I just looked. I've posted a couple of things recently about abortion on Facebook page, and so you know, you always get a lot of comments going back and forth after that. So I just took a couple of these,
right,
and I want you to just show people how does this apply in a real-time kind of quote. So someone responded to one of my Facebook posts recently, and they said, quote, I am ardently pro-life while also recognizing that in this country, a woman should still be able to make the choice in the first 2 months of what she believes is best for her, end quote. So how do you apply what you just taught us to
All right. Well, this is a version of the modified pro-choice position, which, by the way, is a pro-choice position,
yes,
not a pro-life position. Okay? And they're basically saying, I'm pro-life, but there are some reasons that we should allow other people to have abortions, give them the liberty. Here she gave a two-month window. So my question in a circumstance like this is always – the first one, why are you pro-life? In the other circumstances, after 3 months, why are you pro-life? What is your view? That's what do you mean by that, right? Now, my suspicion is, and I actually had this conversation with someone a number of years ago, and he said, well, I think that abortion kills an innocent human being. But, you know, in his case, he was saying, but I think, you know, so I'm not going to have abortion or be involved in one or help my daughter or whatever. But I don't think we should be telling other people what they should be doing. And in this case, it's now in this 2 month time frame. So then my question, in that case, all I did was read back what he'd said. I said, so in other words, if I misunderstand you, let me know. You are just telling me that abortion kills an innocent human being, and you believe people should be allowed to do that in this country. He said, well, when you put it that way, I said, put it what way? That's your view.
That's your way.
Yeah, that's your way, not my way. If I misunderstood it, clarify it for me, but I didn't misunderstand her view. Now, a variation of that can be applied here. So if you're pro-life because abortion kills an innocent human being, what does it matter how old that innocent human being is? A 1 month, 2 months, 5 months, 8 months, a year after birth? If it's wrong to kill the innocent human being, what difference does it make that it's only in the first 2 months? Now, notice that that's a question that is meant to trade on what I think is a flaw in our thinking. The age is irrelevant if the unborn is an innocent human being. If
Right.
it's not an innocent human being, then abortion isn't wrong at any time. If it is a human being, innocent human being, how does it make it more morally acceptable to allow women to kill their own innocent human children if they do it within the first 2 months? Now, I know what she's thinking. Well, it doesn't look like a human being at that time. I mean, this is what a lot of people say. My response is, it looks exactly like all human beings do at that stage of development. You know, look at your pictures. You look at your high school picture, then you look at your picture now. You're totally different. You know, sometimes you can't even recognize yourself. Okay, certainly true in my case. All right. So living things change over time, but it doesn't change what the living thing is. All right. So that's the idea behind it. And my questions now are going to be informed by that idea. And I want that person to justify this distinction. What about 2 months and 1 day, 2 months and a week,
right,
2 months and 3 months? What's the difference here? That's the question. What's the difference? There is no difference with regards to the issue that's most important. What is it?
Right.
That innocent human being comes into existence at fertilization. And from that point on, a brand new human being exists. This is embryology. This is science. This is not religion. Okay? So how do we treat innocent human beings that we don't want?
that are too expensive, that are in the way, that interfere with our career. What do we do? Well, you know, what if they're 3 years old? We say, oh, man, I wish I'd never had this kid. Now I can't get this movie star role. You know, remember that actress at the Oscars who made that comment? I had an abortion. I'm glad I did because now I can be rich or famous. I mean, that really was the substance, and everybody was applauding her.
Right.
Okay. But, okay, well, why don't we just off the three-year-old? What does it matter when it is if we can get rid of them because they're inconvenient? Because it doesn't – children don't cease being inconvenient when you give birth.
Right.
That's when they start getting really inconvenient. Right. So anyway, that's some of the rationale here that I play out in the two chapters I have on abortion.
And I feel like whenever I engage in these conversations or see pro-choice kinds of comments, so often it's really not even about the worldview. It's a logical error that people are making. They're not even thinking consistently about it, because it comes down to these kinds of issues of, oh, wait, so are you saying, like you said, you know, 2 months and one day? Or the only person that would be totally consistent in this if they are pro-choice is if they are a pure naturalist. They believe that there's no objective moral law. Everything is morally relative, and therefore they think that you should be able to kill anything, anyone, anywhere, anytime. In that case, that is purely a worldview issue where you say, well, okay, you're being consistent within your worldview. I might want to challenge that your worldview is the accurate picture of reality, but they're being logically consistent. Yeah. That's a totally different case than the vast, vast majority of people, like 99.9% of the people who do not have that purely morally relativistic worldview, and yet they're making these claims. So often it is a logical type of conversation.
It's like when the woman says, "Well, you're a man," to which I respond, "Yes, so what?" Well, you know, men shouldn't be making decisions about the women's bodies. Okay, now they're assuming that it's just their body. There's more I could say about that, and I cover that in the book. But I have a question. If I was beating my wife, would you object? Yes, of course I'd object. Well, you're not married to her. I am. So what grounds do you have to say anything against me in this circumstance? Oh, that's like bizarre kind of circumstance that could get him angry. Well, wait. Because you're hurting an individual, another human being. And you shouldn't be doing it. It doesn't matter who objects. It's wrong. Oh, okay. In other words, now they've just established a rule. When you're hurting another valuable human being, it doesn't matter who objects.
Right.
It's still wrong. So now the question is, am I hurting another valuable human being in abortion? Only one question. Right back to the basics again.
So I was going to give you another quote, but since you kind of hit on a lot of the points we would have gotten to, I'm going to skip that so we can have some time for listener questions.
Right.
I always put out on my Facebook page, hey, I'm going to interview somebody, and what questions do you have for them? So lots of people had questions for you, Greg.
We
can't take all of them, as usual, but we'll take a few that were especially relevant to the conversation that we're having today. Right. So first one is, what would you say to start a conversation with people who you love dearly, like family, who just want to talk about superficial topics and don't want to get into quote unquote religion? So we've been talking about how to follow up when people make claims, but this one's more of a conversation starter question. How do you even, maybe how do you ask questions to get the conversation started in the first place?
That situation is one of the hardest to deal with, because you have people that are largely apathetic to the real important issues, okay? Or at least seem to be initially, okay? There are some questions that others have recommended to me that I think are good ones to get something rolling, okay? For example, somebody just gave me a card with a question on it here. What do you think is wrong with the world? Okay, lots of crazy things happening right now. Are you concerned? Are you concerned with what's going on in the world? Yes. What is it that concerns you? Okay. What is wrong with the world? Now, this was a question that that G.K. Chesterton answered, and he said, "I am." What's wrong with the world? And very obviously candid response, and that's the right response. But this is a way of getting people talking about it, because when you say what's wrong with the world, you're essentially saying that things are not the way they're supposed to be.
Right.
Okay. Well, if they're not the way they're supposed to be, they should be something else. That means there is a way they're supposed to be. Okay, now we're getting into much bigger issues when we say there is a way things are supposed to be, because you can't have a way things are supposed to be without a sposer.
if there is no God who created the world to be a certain way, then the world can't be wrong. If there's no right way for the world to be, right. It can't be wrong. Now, that I just kind of gave you the long reach of where this question might be going, but to see the backdrop. But all we're doing now is just to get people talking about fundamental, vital issues. What's wrong with the world, you know? And then when people give their answer, you can start questioning aspects of the answer, clarification. So you think that people are doing bad things that they shouldn't be doing, okay? Where are you getting this standard to judge people by? This, by the way, is so C.S. Lewis unpacks this notion so well in the beginning, first chapter or two of Mere Christianity, if people want to see how that works out. But notice here, what I'm trading on here, Natasha, is that every human beings are made in the image of God, and they live in the world God made. That's Francis Schaeffer taught me that. And so therefore, the reality is something they bump into all the time, and they end up expressing truths about reality. Yeah, something is wrong with the world. Well, that implies there's a right way for it to be, and there must be someone who's established the right way. And this is behind the objections to the problem of evil. Okay, so what is the right way, and where do we get that from? Not how do we know it, but where do we get it from? We might know the speed limit by looking at the sign, but that's not the sign isn't what makes the speed limit. It just tells us what the speed limit is. Where do we get this idea that that the speed limit is 25 in front of my house? Well, some governing authority had to make that so. All right, and so I do talk about this a lot in the book Street Smarts, especially in the chapter on evil, because I think evil is, as I titled the chapter, evil is atheism's fatal flaw, not theism's, atheism's. Right. So asking questions like that, what's wrong with the world? Or here's another one to get things going and just see what people say. Maybe you can go further, maybe not, but let people are happy to tell you what they think is wrong with the world. You know, they'll probably tell you out even having to ask it. But another one is, what do you think happens when you die? And see what they say. And then you could ask the follow-up, why do you think that's what happens? Right. Now, you may not need to take it further, but this is just a way of getting started. And then you could test the waters as to whether they are interested in pursuing it a little bit more. And then you can follow that with more questions. Or maybe just abandon it, because really what comes out is, well, I don't know and I don't care. You know, you can't do much with a person who's apathetic, but there's some thoughts regarding that question.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question that you can ask people. I love that. Somebody says, can you please tell Greg, thank you. Because of tactics, I've been able to hold my own to some degree in some very difficult discussions without crumbling. How would Greg suggest to proceed when people don't care that they're being illogical? So I like this question because it kind of ties back to what we were talking about earlier. Like, okay, we can be fancy. We can get our questions out. We can demonstrate how, you know, people's worldview doesn't really fit together. But what do you do when somebody just don't care? Like, you show them something and they just... That's it.
Okay, I'll tell you what's happening there. They're not telling the truth. All right. Now, you can't just say that to them directly, but there are a lot of people who say that. I get this challenge a lot. And in fact, I had the same point of view when I was not a Christian. And I was a moral relativist who at the same time thought the war in Vietnam was wrong. It was an immoral war. That's what I said. And then I thought, wait a minute, that doesn't work. I was actually aware of it. And then I said, I don't care, because I was getting what I wanted in both cases. You know, yeah. It's like the carburetor on the computer kind of thing. You know, it didn't really work together, but I was picking and choosing what I liked. And so now here's the deal. And I made a comment a few moments ago about Francis Schaeffer saying that we're all made in the image of God. Well, in the tactics book, there's a tactic called Inside Out, where I describe the fact that what God has put inside of us is going to come out, even when we're not trying to acknowledge it, all right? And so when a person says, I don't care about my view being coherent and contradictory, I just don't care about that, okay, fine. Let that lie. I presume this is somebody you might be talking about with regards to other things, friend in your life, whatever. Just keep your ears open when they object to something that somebody else does that is not coherent or consistent. Well, that's, and there are different ways they might express this. Well, that doesn't work. They said this and then they did this. Oh, wait a minute. I'm really confused about what you just said. What do you mean I'm confused about what you said? They said they're Christians and they're living like this. They're hypocrites. Wait. Now, that's what confused me. Why? You told me earlier that you don't care if people's actions or views are consistent. And now you're complaining about the Christians being inconsistent. So what is it? Is it important to be consistent or not? If it's not important, why are you saying this about the Christians? If it is important, then why aren't your own views consistent? Okay, there it is. That's street smarts. All right, now it's their turn to answer. And I don't know what they're going to say, but what you've shown them, mic drop moment, you've shown them there's a big problem here. And I think that it's the image of God that's the truth thing that comes out when they're not thinking about it, and this happens all the time.
Yeah, and people are not very likely to want to just admit it on the spot, right?
Right.
you really caught me. They'll just say, well, I don't care. I think you're absolutely right. Everyone does care. They're just not going to say it out loud. And here you are years later saying, hey, I was in that spot.
That's right.
And look what you're doing now. So it can definitely change. Well, let's end on one final question that kind of is a twist on everything we've been talking about today. We've been focusing on, how do you engage with non-believers? But several people posted questions that all kind of gathered around the topic of how do you engage well with fellow Christians, people who identify as a fellow believer, but they have some really wrong theological beliefs. For example, maybe they're caught up in the prosperity gospel. So what are some key questions that you might ask someone who's a fellow believer to get them thinking and talking about some of the beliefs they have that might not be biblical?
Okay, so this is where the first two questions are really valuable. What do you mean by that? How did you come to that conclusion? All right. And so if there's a belief in question, you want to get that you think is a problem, then you want to get that Christian to flesh it out a little bit more, say it more directly and unambiguously. Okay. I think that all, for example, I think that all Christians should be healthy, wealthy, and healthy. How does that line go? Healthy, wealthy, and happy, or something like that. Okay. Now, why would you think that? What do you think the Bible teaches that? Really, where is that? I mean, help me out here. Okay, that's the second question. How did you come to that conclusion? So then, now I know there's a problem with that doctrine, and here's my simple way of pointing out the problem. is it borderline preaching a little bit, because it's not exactly, because the question they're not going to be able to answer. Do you know what group kind of group of Christians that the book of Hebrews was written to? No, suffering Christians. Oh, I didn't know that. Do you know what kind of group the First Peter was written to? No, suffering Christians. Do you know who First Thessalonians was written to? Suffering Christians. Second Thessalonians, suffering Christians. By the way, do you know where Paul was at when he wrote Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, and Second Timothy? No, he was in prison. Okay, now help me out. How is it, given those facts about the Bible, that you're advancing this particular view as biblical? And there you go. I don't know what they're going to say, but hopefully they're going to get thinking. That's the prosperity gospel kind of thing. And I think that same approach can be used with just about anything else. Get people to clarify exactly what they mean, and then begin asking questions of a biblical nature. See, you're going to have to go back to the text now. What is it that justifies the view you have? Now, sometimes these views are going to be more complicated. All right, they're going to be the kinds of things that seem to be the case in Scripture, but a more balanced understanding of the teaching of Scripture will disqualify the view. You know, here's a common misunderstanding out of the Upper Room discourse, John 15, 16, 17, whatever. And Jesus promises the Holy Spirit, who will lead you into all truth. And so people say, yep, the Holy Spirit's going to lead me into all truth, okay? And that's how we know, the Holy Spirit. I said, well, wait a minute. Do you agree with all your other Christian friends that are born again? No. Well, then, obviously, the Holy Spirit has failed if that's what that verse means. Because you have a different sense of what the Holy Spirit is telling you the truth is, and somebody else says that. Do you think they're not Christians? No, I think they're Christians, and you're a Christian. Well, then how is it that the Holy Spirit hasn't led everybody to the same truth? Oh, that's a problem, right? Well, the problem is in the understanding of what was going on in the passage. That particular statement was about the apostles, not about Christians. and that Jesus is giving them authority to speak for him as they go forward and he's gone, right? And the Spirit is going to help them speak with one voice and one mind to give the truth, establishing in their writings and their teaching the foundation for Christianity theologically. That's them. That's not us. Okay, but notice it requires asking a few questions about the implications of that view and then going back to the text and parsing it a little more carefully. Okay, and that's going to be the case. And sometimes you're just going to have disagreements. But on the really important things, you know, like for example, big issue right now is homosexuality in the Bible. I mean, the Bible is not ambiguous about this. It is not in the slightest bit ambiguous. It is not a gray area. People, they complain about Christians using the so-called clobber verses. There's six of them. You mean there's six really clear verses in the Bible that says homosexuality is wrong? And these are God's verses? So you're saying God is clobbering homosexuality six different times? Well, yeah, it's not ambiguous. And there are a number of other issues right now that are very clear scripturally that the church is being wooed away from. And it reminds me of 2 Timothy chapter 3 and 4, you know, that that trouble in the world, chapter 3, trouble in the church, chapter 4. The last thing that Peter says, the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled. They will accumulate to themselves teachers according to their own desires, and will turn aside from truth and turn to myths. Myths are man-made doctrines that do not comport with the clear thinking of Scripture, but this is happening everywhere. And that's why I'm so happy for what you're doing, Natasha, in all your ways and all your books and all your writing and your blogs and your podcasts and everything you're doing. Plus, you got a family to raise, you know, so you're a hard worker, and I'm glad to be a partner with you in that project.
Well, I appreciate that so much and really appreciate your time today for this interview. It's been wonderful and so helpful. And everybody listening needs to get Street Smarts. I mean, this is just a little sample of everything that's in there. It's a wealth of information, but actually really easy to read too. So it's not like a giant textbook where you're memorizing all this stuff. It is a very accessible book. So please be sure to get that. I'll have a link directly to it in the show notes, but you can get it wherever books are sold. And Greg, where would you want to point people in terms of going online and finding out more about you and Stand Reason if they're not already connected?
Well, str.org, Stand to Reason, STR is the acronym, str.org is the best place to go. And we'd love to have your people connected with us because we want to have a discipleship role in their lives. We want to be there, have them part of our community, not just your community, so that we can give them the things that they need. And our website is just chock full with things. And I have my own podcast that I do 2 hours a week. And then I do 2 half hours with Amy Hall a week. And they have #STRAsk, and I commend that to people if they're interested in that. And of course, they can get the book at our website, str.org. I think it's actually still a little bit cheaper at str.org than it is at Amazon, but that's also Amazon's a fast place for people to pick up a book and get it immediately. And if you're just chomping at the bit to read Street Smarts, okay, go to Amazon, you'll have it tomorrow. Okay. So by hook or by crook, you know, I'd love to have you get this book.
And I would reiterate that STR has just so many different resources. So you go to the site and there are books, there are podcasts, there are articles. I mean, just everything you can imagine there. And, you know, you mentioned your podcast just as we're ending here. I want to point people to maybe the one before the most recent one called Decision Making and the Will of God. Mm. I just listened to that the other day and it was just outstanding. I really wanted to talk about it in this episode too, but I knew we weren't going to have the bandwidth given everything else. But if you ever wonder about, you know, what's God's plan for my life? How do I make this decision? That is, I'm just going to always be referring people to that episode because it just outlines the simple framework for thinking about it. And it's not in the same way that I think a lot of Christians think about it. So I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes specifically. That's just a random additional note here because I listened to that the other day and I was like, yes. So that's going to go there. I love it. I love everything that you guys do. Thank you so much for being on today.
Oh, that's great. I love you too. And we can talk about any other issue in the future if you want. So I'm at your service, Natasha.
That would be wonderful. Well, thanks everybody for listening today. And as always, if you could take the time to rate and leave a review of the Natasha Crane podcast, I'd appreciate it. It helps more people find out about the show. Thanks for listening, and I will talk with you soon.